Hi guys, welcome to Dead by Tomorrow Interviews. My name is Daniel Winter and my co-host is Andrew Monroe. As we explore different topics that are worth thinking about today, we want to bring in guests to share their own unique perspective. We hope you enjoy hearing from our guests as much as we enjoy talking to them.
Hello everybody, welcome back to the show. We have another author on, which I think our last guest was also an author. So today we have Andrew Brandt, which I will be referring to as Brandt because it gets confusing when I say my own name. I don't know about you, but I really struggle to say Andrew. Like I can't pronounce that name properly for some reason.
And anytime anybody asks me about myself or if I have to differentiate, I always have to use the surname Andrew Monroe as well. You don't have just one name in my world. It's both. It's Andrew Monroe.
There's too many of us running around. It's an unfortunate relic of the 90s and 80s, I guess. We'll Highlander it one of these days and, you know, finish this out the proper way. So, Mr. Brandt, Andrew Brandt, is a author, as I mentioned. He has written numerous books, the latest being Mixtape Before the End of the World. They're all great stories about just different stuff that it seems. He doesn't necessarily have a genre that you can pin him in, unless you want to call it a thriller. The closest I can pin Andrew Brandt in is to the thriller genre, but that does not apply to all of his books. He's a renaissance man of writing. So he also owns the Phone Medic of Amarillo and now Canyon because y'all just opened a new shop. And that's pretty exciting too, because as a fellow IT technology kind of person, that lifestyle is very complicated sometimes. So welcome onto the show, Andrew. We're thrilled to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate the time. Get to right now doing the promotional circuit for not only Mixtape for the End of the World that you mentioned, the latest novel out from Blue Handle Publishing, but also promoting the Lubbock Book Festival later this month here in September. I'll be participating in a couple of panels, an actual hour-long workshop talking about the writing process, and of course, you know, signing books with some of the booksellers out there.
Well, let's jump into that. When is this festival? What panels are you going to be talking about? And what more can you tell us about?
Sure. So the Lubbock Book Festival is taking place the weekend of September 24th and 25th at the, I don't want to butcher the name. I think it's the McCon Public Library in Lubbock. If I mispronounce that, you know, don't shill for me, please. But it's at the public library there in Lubbock the weekend of the 24th. I'll be presenting in the young adult panel with a New York Times bestselling author, A.G. Howard. And then I will be teaching a 1-hour workshop on taking your manuscript from manuscript to published using online tools available for free to any writer.
That is pretty cool. You think there's going to be big attendance there?
I think so. Yeah. Cause I mean, I think this is the first in-person event of this kind in about a year and a half. Whenever I was touring Mixtape for the End of the World back in May and June, when it released, I had a couple of book signings at breweries there in Lubbock, but nothing of this size and magnitude. It's essentially almost every known, I guess you could say, writer in the region will be there that weekend. I think it's something like 20 or 30 authors, including, like I said, the New York Times bestsellers. You know, A.G. Howard's going to be there. Jody Thomas will be there, among others. And then they invited some of the little guys like me.
That's awesome. How long have you been working on this? Like, how long is this conference been in the works, and is this the first time they've had it? Because I went to school in Lubbock, and obviously I've been in Amarillo for a while, and I don't think I heard about us having a literary kind of conference in Lubbock. So did I just miss the boat on this, or is this brand new?
I don't think it's brand new. Again, don't quote me on a lot of this stuff. I do know that they were planning on doing something in 2020 before the pandemic happened and then kind of shut everything down. But I got invited earlier this year, really back in the summer when we thought that the pandemic was kind of slowing down as well, and really looking forward to this kind of event. Now, who knows what's going to happen in a few weeks, but as of right now, it's still on.
Awesome. I've got one more, we can call it intro technical questions on who you are and what you are. Sure. Tell me a little bit about the latest book, Mixtape for the End of the World. And I know how terrible it is for people to ask you to describe your own book, but I want to put your feet to the fire a little bit and see what you got to say.
Sure. So Mixtape for the End of the World is a young adult high school love story set in the last 3 months of 1999. It's about a kid named Derek who moves to a new town, doesn't know anybody, but gets new friends, plays in a garage band, falls in love with the girl next door, and wonders if the world is about to end because of Y2K.
Y2K. God, that brings me back.
Yeah. I mean, it was such a fun, nostalgic trip.
Y2K is something I haven't heard in a long time. My family definitely bought into the, I'll call it conspiracy, had a full generator and everything. So what was your experience like? How much of the book would shape from, you know, what it was like for you to go through Y2K? Because that's a blast from the past.
And it was a lot of fun to write about. It was a lot of fun to kind of play in that world before we had cell phones, when your only source of news was literally what you saw on the news at night and what you read in the newspapers. And, you know, you wouldn't expect, you know, mainstream news media to overblow something in the name of ratings, would you? That doesn't happen. But that's actually what happened back in 98 and 99 is my stepdad was a systems admin in the Air Force. You know, we saw people, you know, hoarding gasoline and hoarding water and buying generators. And he was like, guys, we've had this fixed for a year and a half. Like, this is not a big deal. But people saw what they saw on television, on the nightly news every night, and read what they read in the newspapers. Going back and doing some of the research on that time period and the kind of things that people saw, it was really funny. I mean, there were news reports that at the stroke of midnight, you know, the electrical grid was going to fail. There would be packs of wild dogs roaming the streets. And those two things don't make sense to me, but they make for a scary post-apocalyptic scene.
That honestly kind of sounds fun, like going back and reading about all of Y2K. And what does the research process look like for your books? Do you go into that level of in-depth research for every single one of your books, or was that more just for this latest
one? It was really more for this latest one because I was writing, you know, at this point, you could almost categorize it as historical fiction. And so for me, because the book is also based around music, I really needed to make sure that, you know, some of the songs that I referenced or some of the artists that I referenced were either one, were still around in 99 or their first album hadn't come out quite yet. You know, I wanted to make sure that I was historically sound there. But really, it was so much fun. The Y2K scare is kind of the bedrock of the story. It's really about this kid who moves to a new town. He's playing in a rock band and he wants to be a rock star. And if you ask every, you know, 15-year-old right now, every single one of them will tell you, I'm going to be a rock star when I grow up. I want to be a YouTube star. I'm going to be a TikToker. I'm going to be an NBA star. I'm going to be a professional baseball player. But of all the kids that do this, you know, what is the actual percentage of these kids that actually make it? You know, I know for me, you know, I didn't go to the NBA. I'm not a professional baseball player. I didn't become a rock star, but I wanted to really think about growing up with that fear in the back of your head of, am I going to be able to pursue my dreams? Am I going to be able to do what I want to do? Or is the world going to end?
Do you think there's any parallels to maybe how kids feel today? Because I mean, I feel like today is just as crazy with COVID and all of those kind of things happening. So did it feel like there were parallels between Y2K and how maybe a 15-year-old would feel today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's actually why I wrote the story and why I published it when I did. There are absolute parallels between the media of what we see pushed on a daily basis regarding, you know, the pandemic now or the Y2K scare then. I mean, it's a constant cycle. And even now, news cycles and social media feeds are really, I mean, they're narrowed down and targeted to the persona and the individual person. And so you can really delve into those kind of fears.
It is so interesting playing with stuff like that. Like, I'm jealous. It's a book I would have wanted to write. So that's pretty cool. Let me pivot you a little bit. So we've talked a little bit about how you did your research. And I want to keep kind of going down that vein, but something we talked about years ago was whether you're a pantser or a planner. I remember what you said, but I want to see if your answer has changed. And if so, you know, if so or if not, what's the reasoning behind how you write?
Oh, I will tell you right now, I know exactly what you're referencing. I used to be solely a pantser. And I'm going to just as myself, just say that's because I didn't know what I was doing at the time. I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't understand a lot of the processes behind that. So for me, now when I sit down to write, I don't even put pen to paper or, you know, keyboard to word file. until I at least have some kind of roadmap in place. I don't necessarily plot out or create an outline for the entire book, but I at least need to know where I'm going. And I also know that there are specific beats that readers expect you as a writer, that they expect you to hit. And so I need to make sure that I'm doing that in that process. So yeah, it's a totally different process from the way I used to write. My first few books, I think suffered because of that. I think The Treehouse, though The Treehouse is a great seller for me, and The Abduction of Sarah Phillips are great stories, they don't really go any deeper than that surface level story that they are. Whereas Mixtape for the End of the World and the book I'm working on now, there's an underlying sense, Daniel, I know you kind of brought it up too, you know, there's an underlying sense like with Mixtape of the kind of fears we're seeing perpetrated through the media now with the coronavirus that we saw during Y2K, you know, this kind of 20-year news cycle that we saw there. So I could have written specifically just a surface level story about a guy going to a new school, learning how to play instruments, learning to be in a band. But really for me, the story was much bigger than that. And I could not have written that kind of story without having those kind of plot beats in place. And Andrew, I'm so sorry. That is a really long answer to a short question.
I love long answers to short questions. I am doing my job right. If I could ask a really short question, you talk for, you know, 30 minutes straight and we're done. One question, one answer, podcast over.
And I know that you're going to be doing some writing workshops soon. I'm going to give you a chance to maybe do a little bit of one right now. Y'all used these terms. Prancer, please explain to me what you're talking about. Explain to the audience what these different styles are. I think that might help kind of relay how you've grown as a...
Sure. So I believe it's George R.R. Martin and Andrew Monroe. You can correct me on this if I'm wrong. He calls them either architects or gardeners.
I'll go with it. I don't know if it was okay. George R.R. Martin or not.
And they also go by pantsers or planners. And pantser basically means that you write from the seat of your pants. Whereas a planner generally outlines. Now, these aren't mutually exclusive. There is some Venn diagram overlap here. For me, I don't necessarily outline an entire story, whether you use, you know, a three-act structure or you're using a romancing the beat structure, but there are specific beats. Let's say in a contemporary romance novel, there are a handful of beats throughout the story that a reader of that genre would expect you to hit, where, you know, the meet cute, the, you know, learning of each other as you go through the story, the quote unquote all is lost moment, and then the grand gesture where you win the woman back and live happily ever after. These are specific beats that you need to hit in a story. Now, some writers like Stephen King are really good at being able to write by the seat of their pants and just have a story idea and just start writing and see where it goes from there. Others need to have, I know Jerry Jenkins, who wrote the Left Behind series, requires himself to have an entire outline of the story before he even actually starts his first draft. He wants to know exactly each beat, each scene, what happens, what the characters want, what's keeping them from getting what they want, how they overcome that. For me, I call my system more of a roadmap. I don't necessarily outline every single scene. I do know some of the things that I want my characters to do or to succeed in or not succeed in. But at a certain point, I do kind of let the writing dictate some of that as well.
There you go. I like it. And that's a great example. It's almost everybody falls that writes, as far as I've heard about, you know, falls under those two. They either just write by the flow or they work on it in a planning manner, you know, outlines, that kind of thing. I do think for any aspiring writers out there, planning what you want to do is a great idea. It's really tempting to just write and go with it. But if you make that outline and be like, hey, I want this chapter to have this and I want this chapter to have this, it lets you introduce more elements of kind of like that wow moment. Because it's hard to make that happen naturally, just freestyling it. So, you know, once you get to Stephen King's level, you know, go for it. Do whatever you want. But sure, it's definitely worth trying.
Andrew, let me ask you. I'm going to flip the tables on you now. I'm going to be asking the questions.
Oh, no.
I mean, what is your process looking like now? I mean, how many drafts are you going through? What are you doing?
So whenever I'm playing around, so to say, let me roll back to the very first thing I wrote. So I thought I was writing, and this is actually goes back to also our emotion versus action kind of mindset, which if you are a planner and you can get stuck in a bad cycle of just planning and not actually taking any action. So always be careful that you're making action and not just motions to make action. So I made a lot of motion by planning the first book, and I probably spent a year making an outline for a book.
Gosh, I remember you telling me that, yeah, that your outline for A Leaf and Pebble was 100 pages, something like that. I mean, you were...
Yeah, it was like 40,000 words or something.
Yeah.
It was a small book in itself. Then I didn't, you know, and by the time, that's the problem is I got stuck in that cycle. And I'm still a planner because I just have this type A kind of personality. But after a year of making this giant outline, that idiom plans, what is it? Plans survive until first contact with the enemy or something like that. I'm butchering that. We'll throw it in the show notes so someone can be like, oh, that is an actual idiom that Andrew didn't make words slap together. So that's what happened with the outline. I spent all this time and effort on an outline and I didn't know what the writing process looked like or anything like that. So that outline basically got me character names and geographic locations to an extent. You know, it didn't survive first contact with the enemy. So I spent a lot of time doing that. In hindsight, making a much looser outline is a good idea. So I'm still an outliner, but I'm a lot more by chapter and kind of a generic, hey, this is what I want to happen versus overarching minute detail. Because it throws off your whole outline if it's chronological.
I like that a lot. In fact, with mixtape, I went kind of through chapter by chapter. I would just, you know, type chapter one and then underneath that heading, just this is what happened in this chapter. And then chapter two, the same thing. It went on and on and on. This is what happens. This is, you know, these are the struggles that these characters are going to have. And this is how they're going to get out of it. And I think honestly, writing that way has made me a better writer. There are certain things that you don't even think of whenever you're making a first draft, but that you understand whenever you're doing that outline. Like, I worked really with the rule of threes with mixtape for the end of the world. So when you read the novel, you'll see that there's three interactions with the bully in the story. There's three interactions with the girl that Derek falls in love with, three rooftop scenes. There are three interactions with the mentor character. And all of this rule of three, these threes, they engage and sway in and out of each other to form this cohesive story. It's something that I could have never done whenever I first started. It's something I could have never done without having those kind of plans in place of writing a novel. I don't believe that I was mature enough as a writer to publish my first story the way I did. The Treehouse. I'm proud of the story because it's the first novel I ever wrote, but it's not on par with the rest of my stuff. And it's because of the way that my writing process has changed over these last few years.
So now I don't want to have too many spoilers out there, but is this maybe going to make it into the talk at the festival?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the things I want to do is in my workshop is help aspiring writers who attend, one, learn the processes of taking their manuscript from a Word file to a self-published novel. And the tools are available online to do that for free. If you don't want to go through the querying process, if you don't want to find an agent and you just want to get your book out, it's absolutely free to do so. And that's one of the things I'm going to teach in my workshop at the Lubbock Book Festival.
That's awesome. Is there a favorite tool you have that you want to throw out there?
Oh, you know, I use for getting the Word file from a Word file to a book file, essentially. I like the Vellum program.
Oh, Vellum's beautiful.
Vellum's beautiful.
Oh my goodness.
But it isn't free. There are free applications. Amazon makes one called Kindle Create. If you just want your book on Kindle, you can use the Kindle Create program and it creates your Word. It takes your Word file and imports it into a file that's readable on a Kindle. You can then upload to the Kindle distribution program.
No, those are good. And that was something that I'm sure you ran into as well, but very surprising if you're doing the self-published route, obviously, you know, if you have a publisher, you probably don't have to mess with these kind of things, but getting a Word document to be okay on Kindle and look good is miserable. It's awful. I would highly recommend grabbing Vellum because it makes it maybe an hour process versus, in my case, a 2-week process, yanking my hair out, wondering what I did in a past life to deserve this kind of torture and pain. I don't know about you. You're probably smarter than me and you're better with computers, but it was awful.
Yeah. Well, I've been on both sides of that coin now, from doing everything indie and self-published to having a small publishing company who kind of does all that for me now. At this point, you know, my responsibility with the manuscript is basically handing it to my publisher and saying, thanks for the check. Thank you for the money. Have fun. But going from that world of self-publishing, it also took a lot for me to give up a lot of that control. I loved doing the paperback cover file myself. I liked formatting the novel myself. I thought it was a lot of fun, but I can see where if you just want to be a writer and you don't want to be a marketer, you don't want to be a graphic design artist, you don't want to be a book formatter, you don't want to be an editor, you're self-publishing. I mean, all those hats fall on your head. And I can see where, you know, for a new author, it was for me, it was incredibly hectic.
So what was the turning point where you decided that you wanted to go with a publisher? How many of your books did you self-publish before that?
I self-published my first three novels, The Treehouse, The Abduction of Sarah Phillips, In the Fog. And then with my fourth novel, Palo Duro, that's kind of where things changed a little bit for me. It was May of 2020. We were in the very beginning stages of the coronavirus pandemic. And I had this entire book tour planned that all of a sudden couldn't happen anymore. And I considered, as the self-publisher, I considered, well, do I push this book back? You know, we were told it was only going to be 2 weeks. And here we are in May. You know, what do I do here? Luckily, the book found an audience. It debuted at number one in the young adult section on Amazon. And the book completely changed my life. And that is when Blue Handle Publishing came around and offered a book contract for my next few books.
Gotcha. So why did you decide to go with that contract instead of maybe continuing to self-publish? Because it sounds like you did like some of the aspects of the self-publishing. You had found a little bit of success. So why make the jump to a publisher?
When Blue Handle approached me to be on their roster, they were just beginning. The president of the company wanted to start a publishing company. And he approached me because he liked my writing. He liked that I was marketable to an already existing audience that I had built, of course. And so it worked out really well where I kind of wanted to get away from handling all those processes myself. I had an infant daughter on the way. She was born in July of last year. And frankly, I simply just wanted to write at that point. I wanted to be able to write my story and kind of give those hats to someone else to wear for a little bit.
That's exactly what I think most indie publishers or indie authors will come to realize is it's really fun the first couple of times. And then you go, wait, I could have written a second or third or fourth book with the amount of time it took for all the other things that were not writing that I did. Unless you just really enjoy it, it really is just massively time consuming.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at one point, not only was I writing the novel, but then doing all of my marketing myself, all of my web design myself, I hired an editor. His name's Brandon Biggers, and Brandon's fantastic. But that's, I mean, aside from editing, I kind of did everything myself at that point. And don't get me wrong, it was a lot of fun. It was enjoyable at some points, made me want to pull my hair out at other points. But then, like I said, when Blue Handle came around and they offered the contract, I knew that it was time for me to just be a writer at that point and let somebody else handle all the marketing aspect.
That's how it goes, man. Okay, before we fully wrap up and jump into the end of the episode story time and whatnot and challenge, I've got one last little bit of something I want you to at least tell me about. I don't know if it'll apply to anybody else. Daniel might not care, but we have a mutual friend that I haven't talked to you about yet, Travis Tidmore. I ran into him at Powis because he had a Roosevelt shirt on and I had a Roosevelt shirt on. Yeah. And he came busting out through the door pointing at me like he wanted to fight, and then I saw his shirt and I knew what he wanted, and I was like, oh yeah, I got you. So Travis is a really cool guy, and oh, yeah. I heard this a little bit from him, and then I saw it on Amazon as well. Y'all are finishing up a book together, a novella?
We are in the process of, unfortunately, it's nowhere near finished. So long story short, I'm under the gun with Blue Handle on my next book. I turned in my first draft and it got torn apart. So I've been working furiously on this. But no, Travis and I, around Halloween time last year, put out a novella called Frightland. It was based on a story idea that he and I had kind of talked about. And I loved the story idea. I thought it'd make a great short story, great novella at the time. And then we started fleshing out kind of this world of this Frightland world. And it's a fun, still doing kind of self-publishing with it. Unfortunately, I have not been able to pay as much attention as I would like to the Frightland story at this point. However, do know that Travis and I are still working on it. He's got it outlined. I'm working on the first draft now. It's going to be really cool whenever it's finally released. It's really a throwback to the old 70s and 80s slasher movies. It's a lot of fun to play in that kind of world where camp is okay. where camp is fun. And man, it's a blast.
That's awesome. I can't wait for y'all to have it out because that sounds like a fun time.
Yeah, me neither. And I'm, like I said, I'm under the gun on a couple of different projects, and but Frightland is definitely up there. It will be released hopefully within the next, I would say 6 months or so. We were hoping to have it ready for Halloween of this year. It just didn't happen. But with Yellow City Comic Con coming back in April, I think they're kind of doing a Halloween in theme, you know, or a horror film theme for Yellow City this year. I think it'd make a great, great time to debut that novel too.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to it, man.
Thank you.
Well, let's jump in to the last two traditional things we get out there. First is story time. So if there's any stories you want to share about your life, your writing, you know, the actual job that you've had in your life, that owning the company, Phone Medic, that is. If there's anything about Daniel or I, or whatever, make it up, do whatever. If you've got a story, we'd love to hear it. And then while you are multitasking there, we'll have you present a challenge to the audience if you got one.
Okay. I would like to tell you a story about the leather jacket kid.
When I was
in middle school, I decided I was going to wear a leather jacket every single day to school. Black t-shirt, leather jacket, unzipped, looking super cool. I wouldn't say anything either. I would kind of stand off to the side, just observe people, look cool. And people would know that I was the coolest guy on the block. Definitely the coolest guy in sixth grade. I would also keep an extra large pack of cinnamon gum in the pocket of my jacket. And every single day, I'd chew one stick of gum. I wouldn't give anybody, until one day that I would find the most bodacious, curviest, hottest, brainiest eighth grade girl in all of middle school. I'd go up to her and I'd say, "Hey, you want a stick of gum?" And everybody from that point would know that we were boyfriend and girlfriend, and they would call me the leather jacket kid. Now, obviously, that never happened. But as a sixth grader with an overactive imagination, these are the kind of things that I thought about.
I don't even know what to tell you about that. I can see it, though. I 100% believe this story. Is it the same leather jacket you still wear?
Of course.
Okay, just making sure. I mean, I haven't grown since eighth grade, so.
No. I lost that leather jacket a long time ago.
That's awesome. Middle school's rough, man. Well, all right. What kind of challenge do you have for the audience?
So not everybody is a writer, not everybody is a reader, but I think everybody has ideas. And I think just because of the world that I live in, whenever I'm at a book signing, or I'm at a library talking with people, or at a middle school talking with kids, I get this one sentence all the time, and it's, "I would love to do that. I just don't have time." And so right now, if you're listening to this and you're one of those people and you're saying, "I've got story ideas. I've got tons of ideas. I just don't have time." What I want you to do is, if you're an iPhone person, every single week, if you have it set up, your phone will tell you how much time you average per day on your phone. That's time you could be spent writing. And so I challenge you this week, whether it's 10 minutes a day or an hour a day, I would love for you to sit down at your laptop or with a notebook and start writing some of those ideas. Get them out of your head onto paper, and you would surprise yourself, even just a week, how much you can get done.
That is a great challenge, and I fully support it. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. It has been a pleasure getting to hear from you and pick your brain a little bit on the writing process. For everybody listening, please check out that festival in Lubbock. I think you'll have a really good time if you're in the area. If not, we'll try and keep you updated on how it goes. So everybody else that's listening, thank you, and we look forward to connecting with you soon.